Wednesday, and because Representative Morissette felt that some people should have had a chance to testify that didn't feel like testifying, and we brought it back to give them a chance to testify. I will note that on Wednesday it came out unanimously. So with that, do we have a sign up sheet?
I think it's going to be too short.
Boy, here's a good one. Philip Fell? Did you get that one right?
Yeah.
Okay, and Bob Rindy?
Ms. Mayor, committee members, I'm Philip Fell from the Oregon City. Let me begin with a mea culpa and an apology to the committee. This is one of those bills that we became aware of after passed on the Senate side, and I just flat dropped it here. I missed your hearing. I appreciate the opportunity to have a chance. We do not understand the purpose for this bill. There is currently in law requirements that local governments can regulate, but all regulatory standards have to be clear and objective, and they cannot either individually or together have the effect of excluding a manufactured housing park. To the best of our knowledge, there has been no complaint filed with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, which has enforcement authority, or with LUBA, which would be an obvious appeal. So we don't know that there's a problem. We are concerned that this preemption could potentially affect our ability to regulate land use as it relates to salmon recovery. We all know it's coming to cities, and one of the biggest tools that we're going to have to do whatever we need to do is going to be the ability to require setbacks from screens and similar land use actions. So we want to make sure that we are not preempted by this bill. And a general concern has been the street width. I've been at the league for a dozen years now, and ever since I've been there, we have had the controversy between fire people and planners about street width. One of the problems with 20-foot street widths is that if you have two fire trucks trying to maneuver out there, you're going to have a real problem. 20 feet does not allow them to do that. So those are generally our concerns. And again, I apologize. I hope you will consider those concerns. And if there has not been a substantial example given of problems with this, the league would encourage you not to pass a new law. I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Bob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Rindy, and I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I also only became aware of this bill right after Phil did, and that he called us. We're tracking 150 bills and missed this one, and this is to us a significant bill. So I apologize for our late comments as well, but we are very concerned about this. Because we didn't have a chance to see this in advance, enough in advance of this hearing to meet with building codes and to meet with our own legal counsel about all the effects of this, what we would urge you to do is to at least delay this to see if we can try and have those meetings. But let me explain to you what our concerns are. LCDC is very strongly in favor of affordable housing and has a long record of adopting measures and enforcing measures to try and encourage affordable housing. Over the last two decades, we have hand in hand with the manufactured home industry come to the legislature and placed in ORS 197 statutes that make it illegal for cities to preclude manufactured dwelling parks. And those statutes require that cities may regulate dwelling parks, that is to say, they may have local zoning codes, planning commission and zoners may regulate the design of manufactured housing parks. But those design standards have to be clear and objective and cannot have the effect, individually or cumulatively, of denying that housing type. Occasionally, we will see standards that arguably do deny manufactured housing types, and I certainly think it would be a good case if someone were to show that a jurisdiction's street widths were so wide for the type of housing we're talking about that they were essentially trying to hurt the affordability or preclude that housing type. I think that might violate the statute. But I do want to say, no one has brought this issue to us. LCDC meets every month. We have a long history of manufactured housing. Yet this is the first we've heard that there is a problem with cities precluding this housing type. We do have a force enforcement authority. We also have appeal authority. Most land use statutes are enforced through local citizen having the quick and easy option to go to LUBA. Manufactured housing industry could go to LUBA for any of the examples that may have been cited to you of local standards that preclude the housing type. But it's alarming to us that we are now trying to adopt a different law that would greatly take away local government planning authority over these housing types without having had any record of anybody approaching LCDC and saying there's a problem with the current code. We think the current code could work. We would also think that a statute that was more specific, if street widths is the problem, a statute affecting street widths would be a good solution. But we are concerned that we have worked out, I think, over the years, a pretty good partnership with local governments on affordable housing. It's been a long, hard compromise at LCDC. Builders and local governments have been worked out, but the idea is local governments have planning authority. They can review each individual type of manufactured housing park, look at individual examples. The state has never adopted standards to that degree of detail where the state is trying to regulate how you design a manufactured housing park. If we go that route, I would want to be sure that we really need to, and that that we're not acting hasty in that. I think when you look at 140 cities statewide and all the different circumstances on the ground, it's going to be very hard to adopt a uniform standard for the design of something as major as a manufactured home park in the city. And it's a major precedent. I think one has to ask, well, if we do that for manufactured housing parks, why wouldn't we also preempt local zoning authority for apartments, condominiums, and for a variety of other affordable housing types? Those are our concerns. We will be meeting in the near future with the Department with the Building Codes and trying to meet with other parties to see if there would be some, maybe these concerns can be resolved. But at this point, I did want to get them on the record. Thank you.
Bob, I don't recall in the previous testimony that there's a problem with the locating parks. It's just the codes that local governments can put on once the park is located. So your testimony is the fact that LCDC has never heard of a problem that cities are not allowing parks to be located. That was not testified to in at least at our hearing.
Mr. Chair, I may have been misunderstood. I'm not concerned about the location. Our laws do require that each city provide an opportunity for manufactured housing parks. But what I meant is that if local governments are using zoning codes in a manner that would prevent a developer of a manufactured housing park from actually being able to build the park, this is a problem that's been in planning for decades, that zoning codes may have the effect of simply precluding a housing type. And the way local governments do that is they put standards on certain building types that you simply can't meet. When we're talking about building codes, I think it's a good idea to have state standards. But when we're talking about all kinds of things, such as street widths, whether the corner is here or there, whether there's a 6-foot fence around the park, because the neighbors would like to have at least that. I mean, there's a whole lot of design things, very site-specific design things, that I believe this bill would preclude local governments from being able to do that. That means when a manufactured home park developer comes into the community and tries to build one of these things, local governments aren't able to resolve even simple issues with neighbors, such as whether or not there should be a 6-foot fence. I haven't had a chance to research all of that, but if the building codes has the effect of taking away the ability of local governments to add additional standards, such as fence height, street width, and things of that nature, local planners are no longer in a position to be able to just settle simple community conflicts about the design of these things. And we wouldn't want to see that happen. We hope that isn't the effect of this legislation, but we're concerned it might be.
Let me get this straight. You're here representing LCDC, and you are advocating for regionalized local land use planning.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what regionalized local land use planning means, but I'm not at all afraid to say that the myths about LCDC being against local land use planning are not true. Those aren't true. LCDC has broad standards, but we have no history of trying to reach into local codes to the level of detail right now as to whether or not, you know, you could have a 6-foot fence around a subdivision. That level of detail at the state level would be a new precedent for state control, and one that we would never have advocated.
A new standard maybe for LCDC, but not for specialty codes of construction. We do that now at the state level.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, if I could. I think for construction, I'm not at all opposed to a specialty code, but when we're talking about the design, the planning of a park, how it's laid out, that would be our concern, that the state not set a precedent here and create a specialty code that would authorize that level of state standard.
Thank you. Representative Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the main topics of discussion with street width when we had the last public hearing, and I believe the city of Troutdale was used as an example, and then Washington County in general was mentioned, and 36-foot wide streets. And then an example was given concerning how much that would increase the rent per month to put in a street that wide. The rent was kind of based on the ratio of street width. Is this the kind of issue that a manufactured park owner might take to your agency and say this is prohibiting us from economically putting in a park, and we don't think that a 36-wide street is necessary, and they would appeal to you? Is that what you were talking about?
Representative Morris said, I believe LCDC has the authority to adopt administrative rules that may regulate that, and I'm not here to say that I would think it would be an unwise thing if the legislature wanted to regulate street width, because you do believe, and I think you're right, that street width can be something that may have the effect of raising that price of that housing type to where it's no longer affordable. We want to see affordable housing. Our concern isn't with the streets. It's with the much broader implications of the bill, in that by having a specialty code that may preclude local codes that add additional conditions, we end up going way beyond just street width and start to question, you know, raise the question of whether local governments can regulate even simple things such as a fence around the park, or whether certain trees have to be left in there, and you know, a whole range of issues. That's our concern. Street widths, I think we could reach agreement if the bill was to regulate street widths for manufactured housing folks, and I don't see us having a problem with that.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morris, a bill is coming over from the Senate that we worked on earlier this month, and what that bill does is set up circumstances whereby a developer can apply for a permit, receive the permit with conditions, look down, say, okay, oh no, that's crazy, I'm not going to do that, that's not part of the impact here. Under current law, what would happen is that the whole project stops, and the builder and the city go off and sort through whether the city has exceeded its authority, or whether the city has the ability to require that as a condition. What the new bill does is say that, yes, a developer can complain about a condition, say it doesn't apply, and can then go ahead and say, I'm going to build it, but if the court finds that you've exceeded your authority, you're going to pay me back. So we have another mechanism in there to try to keep costs down in circumstances where there's disagreement between the developers.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for coming forward. Everyone else I have signed up, testified previously. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 459 on the work session, Senate Bill 459. Mr. Morissette.
Yes, thank you. I did call our city planner yesterday and talked about the practice in Springfield, and we've adopted the state building codes in regard to manufactured parks, and including setbacks and the width of the sidewalk and ADA standards for sidewalk width and so on. And our normal procedure, because of the fire truck issue, is a 24-foot street. Under very limited conditions, we will allow a 20-foot street going into a panhandle lot. But as far as a 5-acre or a fairly large park, the minimum in Springfield right now is 24, and that is at the recommendation of the fire department. And I think it was mentioned, if you have to have a couple of trucks go in, that 20-foot street just is not wide enough. So I'm not sure if I'm going to support this bill in its existing form, but I did gather that information. Now, the other implications of this bill for, as the gentleman from LCDC testified, I'm not sure what the other ramifications are, and I don't know if we really got into that, so I guess I do have some reservations.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 459 to the due pass recommendation.
Representative Knowlton, move Senate Bill 459 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Morissette?
No.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Atkinson?
Yes.
Representative Bergman?
Excuse.
Representative Knowlton?
Aye.
Representative Lumpkin?
Aye.
Chair
Byers? Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 459 goes before the due pass recommendation. Who was carrying it last time? Okay. Any volunteer?
No, I've got it. Chair. Fire?
Oh. Somebody got to.
Well, you had this one before.
I'll carry the bell again. That was the worst question. Geez, I shouldn't have asked that question. All right, here we are. Senate Bill 1021. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1021. Step up.
Mr. Chairman, current law allows certain utility companies, railroads, canals, irrigation systems, and so forth, to cross public property and to install their systems across public property. The law is not clear that that is usable by people who want to install sewers. This bill would specifically add sewer construction to the list of purposes for which property could be condemned.
Thank you. Dave?
Hinterreiter.
Okay.
Chairman Byers, members. My name is Dave Hinterreiter. I'm with H2ONS, Inc. We own a sewage treatment plant down on the Oregon coast in Lincoln County. The Oregon statute that deals with condemnation of lands for utility services, and I'm going to stress this is just for the transmission of lines, pipelines. This has nothing to do with the actual physical facility, such as a sewage treatment plant or anything else like that. When the ORS 772 and 010 and 015 were passed many years ago, It was definitely a need to get utilities out to rural areas. Back at that time, though, after they'd gotten water and electricity, they just did not contemplate sewage, because at that time, those issues were taken care of as far as cesspools, septic fields, and in some cases, unfortunately, right out onto the ground. We're in a situation down on the coast right now where we've had DEQ approval for 2 years to sewer the area. Our plant is considered the regional sewage treatment plant in the area. And where we ran into a brick wall was going to the county level, because under this ordinance, the county has the right to let different communities in urban growth areas have electricity, use the right-of-ways and easements for electricity, gas, water, but the word sewer is in the bill. So this is basically a housekeeping measure to allow us to get it. This does not give us any right to compel people to hook up onto it. It just gives us the right to get the transmission line in the ground. It was passed unanimously through the Senate without objection. And I would like you to help us along with this, because we just
thank you very much, Representative Thompson.
How much opposition is there locally to you putting that line in there, Dr. Rock?
Representative Thompson, in the area that we're at, in between Newport and Depot Bay, as far as the land ownership issue, the majority of landowners are 100% for this, because they can't build or else their fields have failed. There is a strong silent minority, or there is a small group that is very vocal about not having us put this in there, because it'll mean more growth in the area. We are not asking to go into areas that aren't within the urban growth boundaries. A lot of these lots have been platted for 50 years, but people just can't build on their properties because, first of all, that section of the Oregon coast has mostly clay and hard pan. And the septic field, HGE Engineering and the Department of Environmental Quality did a test study on this area in 1987. At that time, 67% of all of the fields had marginally failed or failed, and 90% of those homes could not have an additional repair field because the lots were too small. Septic fields and cesspools, those were set up for farm communities way back then, where they had a lot of acreage. We didn't have to worry about the problems of sewage running across public and private land. Right now, it's estimated by HG Engineering that we have anywhere between 500,000 and 1 million gallons of raw sewage per month going down onto the Central Oregon Coast beaches from these failed systems. So when we found out that there was a sewage treatment plant, we have a national discharge permit, an MPDES from the EPA, discharge to the ocean 225,000 gallons a day. And this was enlarged in 1981 to take in that entire area between Depot Bay and Newport. Unfortunately, the developers of the plant that were also the developers of some portions of Unit Autocrest have all gone broke over the years. When we picked the thing up 5 years ago, we got with the county, and the county is all for it. The DEQ has already given us approval for the entire pipeline. We went through the engineering and got signed off on that 2 years ago. But where we're at is, because it's not in the statute, that sewer is also in the verbiage. We need that verbiage of sewer lines, as well as the other utilities, brought into the bill.
Thank you very much. Jerry Schmidt, Sunset, do you have anything else you need to add? I think we're ready to remove the bill if you...
Just one question.
Okay, come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We just had a little problem on line 9. I just wanted to let you know that in the Senate side, we're currently moving a bill about notice upon entry to private lands. We're requiring the agencies to give notice to a property owner upon entry to private lands. I noticed in this section there talks about that you shall have the right to enter upon any land for the purposes of examining, locating, and surveying lines. It doesn't mention anything about notice. Again, I'm trying to keep the conflicts down between property owners in corporations or agencies. I don't know if that's a big issue here, but I just wanted to raise the issue to let you know that we're trying to address it. On the other side, you'll have a bill coming to the House, but it is dealing with agencies, not with the corporations. So with that, I'll end my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson.
Who decides who can enter into that property? If the person says, okay, I'm just a sewer employee, does that mean anybody can go onto the property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, as I read the bill, of course, it allows anybody to enter the property that's a representative of whatever, a railroad, sewer, canal, ditch flume employee. I suspect that would allow them for the purposes designated in the statute. I don't think it's been abused badly. I think Representative Lundquist might have some experience with irrigation canals or some other, and Representative Knopp on the same issue. My problem, of course, has been the agencies, because I'm worried about more and more people coming into trespassing issues because of the salmon plan and various other issues that they must coordinate with the landowners, otherwise we're going to have wholesale warfare out there about people entering and walking across property without notice. DFW just sent me a notice as a rural property owner requesting to come through my property that they were going to do a fish count. And that's the kind of thing I hope starts coming about for everyone, that if, in fact, agencies are coming for any reason, and that this is aimed at a different issue, not at agencies. But again, I'm hoping that surveyors or anybody else for any reason coming upon property will at least give folks a heads up so that if somebody has a serious objection, they can raise it with whoever is desiring to enter.
Thompson.
If we were to conceptually amend in, because it's so late, that notification of 10 days prior or something like that, would that solve the problem in this bill?
Certainly would for me, Representative Thompson. I think I have 3 days on the other side just to come up with some type of time frame, either verbal notice or written notice. So I'm trying to make it as simple and as easy as possible for those folks to do that and still accomplish the job.
We ought to make it consistent.
Representative Thompson, the problem, my potential problem with that, and specifically when we're talking about sewer lines, is would you only have to wait 10 days if your sewer line is broke on your property and they need to get in there to fix it and you've got a whole community upstream flushing?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's 10 days a little long.
I was just looking for a date or some kind of a frame to protect landowners.
I understand and I recognize your concern, but when you're talking about sewer.
Mr. Chairman, the trouble as I see it is that it's just examining is the issue. For locating and surveying, I think there needs to be. But I know on the, the irrigation ditch, it's got a problem. They better be there as soon as possible. I agree with the notice. I know last session, there was a session before, we talked about surveyors. We had a lengthy discussion. We passed a bill, and there was notice. That was a big issue, that they gave notice prior to going. Mm-hmm. Well, and I know it's taken care of in that aspect, but I think the Jerry's comments are right on target. I'm not just sure how to handle it.
Yeah, I would agree that for the examining or repair of, I don't think that once the line is there and everyone knows it's there and if there's a problem with it, we want people to fix it as soon as possible. But for the locating and the surveying, it seems like a notice provision should be or would be important. Representative Thompson, would you be willing to go to Legislative Council and see if you can work that out when you put this on?
I'd be more than happy to work with Jerry.
We'll put it on Wednesday's schedule. Hopefully we can get a quick fix and we can move the bill through in 5 minutes or less than what next Wednesday.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 21. Okay. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1310. Public hearing. My bill, but it's not a Senator Byers. Mr. Putman.
Mr. Chairman, this bill, Senate Bill 1310, was a portion of a much, much larger bill. I believe it was Senate Bill 182 in the Senate, which fell on hard times. This particular piece has been pulled out. It cleared the Senate 30-0. The Primit bill talks about, in the summary, about residential transactions. That is an error. LC knows that's an error. That should either read non-residential or commercial, but it's not residential, and the text of the bill does this. This allows realtors to enter into agreements with out-of-state realtors and under the supervision of a licensed Oregon realtor to provide certain realtor services of a commercial nature.
Genoa et al., go ahead and start wherever you want.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I'm Genoa Ingram, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I will be very brief, as Mr. Putnam has given a very good overview of what the bill does. ORS 696 currently has a prohibition sharing commissions with non-licensed individuals, and that could include individuals who are licensed in other states. Normally, that's not a problem. However, in commercial transactions, you may have someone, for example, from Hilton Hotels, who comes into Oregon. They want to have their own broker there, and once they step foot into the state and try to work out a transaction, then they are in violation of ORS 696. Page 2 of the bill lays out very specific conditions whereby the individual may negotiate and show property and also under the supervision of a licensed broker within the state of Oregon. There was one concerned voice on the Senate side with regard to, I believe the concern was that real estate brokers in Oregon would willy-nilly just start charging, $40 or $50 for out-of-state people to come in and just start practicing at will. We do not see that as a threat since the Oregon broker is responsible for the activities and actions of the out-of-state broker. So they're going to be supervised pretty carefully. So we don't see that as a problem. As Mr. Putnam said, it did pass the Senate unanimously approximately 12 days ago. With me today are Bob Nelson and Greg Herbert, who are real estate brokers from the Eugene Springfield area, to respond to specific questions you have. The bill also has the support of the real estate agency, and Commissioner Taylor is also here today to lend his support should you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner.
I'm just curious, how many other states have provisions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, for the record, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner. My recollection is there are 15 states that currently have a co-op provision of some sort, as this particular bill elicits. Now, also embedded in the bill is some modifications to our reciprocity statute, which today, if we could make those changes, we could enter into reciprocity agreements with approximately 35 states. So, we're kind of behind the ball on this particular issue. The world's gotten ahead of us.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Does anyone have anything else they need to add? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing. Open the question. Senate Bill 1310.
Mr. Chair, I'll move on. Senate Bill 1310. A to do pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves Senate Bill 1310, Jane Gross to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Atkinson?
Excused.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Snow?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Chair Byers?
Aye. I received the required number of votes. Senate Bill 1310 moves the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Morissette, we've got light in the chair.
No, I don't.
Representative Morissette will carry the bill. Close the work session. All right, let's see now. We're working our way to the bottom. We have House Bill 3333, open a work session, House Bill 3333. This bill is, we need to send to rules, they want to have gotten stuff when it gets there to make it a... Representative...
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3333 to the committee on...
I think technically it has to go to the floor without recommendation and then to be assigned to, we referred to the Committee on Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs. Representative Knoll makes a motion. Is there discussion, objection, or? We have two bills yet. If we can get to them, I would appreciate it. We'll start back in the top with Senate Bill 378. We'll open a work session with Senate Bill 378. We had this bill before us a couple of weeks ago or last week or sometime. Listened to it. Representative Atkinson went out and talked with Representative Shetterly about the bill. Didn't seem to have a problem. We have offered one amendment to the bill that Mr. Putman, is that amendment been passed around to the committee members?
Yes.
It's the dash one amendments. The concerns on the Senate side, why were there so many no votes, was it was an awful big jump to go from 100,000 to 500,000 in one fell swoop. Why offered a compromise amendment to go to 250,000. So that's where we are right now. We have an amended bill with a possible amendment.
That's one question. You have Representative Shetterly's all right with the amendment? Is that what you're saying?
Well, all I know is that Representative Atkinson talked with Representative Shetterly, and his note to me is that he's fine with the 378 amendment, and he'll carry it if I want him to. But I do not know if he shared the amendment with Representative Shetterly. I can't answer that.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash one amendment.
Representative Knoll moves dash one amendment into Senate Bill 378. Is there discussion on that motion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Knoll.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 378 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Knoll moves Senate Bill 371 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes.
Yes, Representative Thompson.
This isn't really enough, but after a brief consultation, the comment was, this is a half a loaf, but it's better than none.
Okay. Other discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Knoll?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 378 moves forward with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Atkinson will carry the bill. We now have Senate Bill 1086. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1086. We heard this bill on, I think it was Wednesday. Is there anything new since then that we don't have in our packet?
My understanding, members of the committee may have an amendment.
I have an amendment now. we have in front of us the dash A2 amendment. As my first glance reading appears, it allows the employers to opt out.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash A2 amendment for the purpose of discussion as well.
Okay, Representative Gardner moves the A2 amendment. My recommendation was after our first hearing that the sponsor of the bill thought that there's an opt-out provision that doesn't do what they want to do. The nodding of the head in the back of the room confirms that.
That's true, Mr. Chair, but it also was the recommendation of the advisory committee for the employment department, and does give protection to the employers. At least according to the advisory committee, majority of them want this provision.
I do recall that. I think we have a letter here from the advisory committee stating that. President Lundquist, do you have a comment?
Yes. I'd like to hear, if it could be just very briefly, from Mr. Cogdill
the safety precautions of not all the records being known then.
Mr. Cosgrove. The record, Paul Cosgrove, sitting PIE. I caught the last part of record.
Okay. Discuss the area of all of the records not just being accessed so one, someone could see everything.
The bill specifically delineates what information can be disclosed, but it also gives very broad authority to the department to adopt rules on exactly how that will be disclosed. There are models in other states that make it clear that the most common way is to build a firewall, and these are set out in the rules that the department does and then made part of the contract, so that only those pieces of information about that one employee move over the firewall at the time of the request. Not specified in any greater detail in the bill because we don't know the exact technological way, given the state's exact computer system, that we will do that. But we've given the department great authority, and we've also specified that only that limited information can come across.
And is it anticipated that you have authority from an employee to pull this information out? You will not be able to access other records at the same time?
Correct, Representative Lundquist. We have to have the consent form as specified in the bill, and we can only access that one employee's information at that one time. And we would have to have another consent form for somebody else to do anybody else. So it's only a small piece of each time.
Okay. And you have to have a consent form, but from a just a straight, if someone wanted to, could they access something else without the access?
No, Representative Lundquist. They couldn't. It would be a violation of the contract. There are also auditing requirements. On the Senate side, when my client came up to talk about the auditing requirements, typically what we do is we audit every 3 days, make sure that the consent forms are there. We bring in an outside auditor, and that's what other states have required us to do periodically, generally quarterly or semi-annually, to make sure that's happening as well. So they're generally speaking quite specific protections to make sure that that doesn't happen. We also carry liability insurance and are generally required to by the states, and we offer that as part of our contract to make sure that if there are any damage because of unauthorized release, there's insurance for the state agency as well as everybody else involved.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to get that sort of on the record.
I'd just like to ask Ms. Talbot to come up here for a minute and ask her a couple of questions about the advisory committee.
Okay. Did you have more you want on the record?
No, that's all right.
Okay.
My understanding is that that the reason the business folks on the advisory committee objected to this is because they feel it's proprietary information, their information.
Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, legislative coordinator for the Employment Department, for the record. Yes, Representative Gardner, that is their way that they perceive that information, and in fact under the statute now the information is confidential and is not released to any other outside private third party at this point in time.
And if this amendment is adopted, then basically there would be a checkoff box where they could check off to opt out, but they would otherwise get the information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, that is the way it's drafted, so that that the presumption would be that you're in unless you have specific fears about releasing your information, then you could opt out. I would like to say for the record as well that I know that Mr. Cosgrove had said that this would be of concern to them because some records would then not be in the system. We would certainly work with their organization to show that if a particular employer had opted out, that we could reflect that in the run when they got the information, that the consumer reporting agency would know that there perhaps are some wages that are not recorded here because they're one of the employers is not participating in the electronic disclosure system, so then they could get that specifically from that employer. So we would hope that we could work with them to reflect their concern that if some employers are not in, that they would know that and they would trigger that. And we would also note that there are employees who aren't covered by unemployment insurance, so their records won't be in there either. So there are already some gaps in the information that they would have to deal with. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess I have to put on the record that this is a Form 132 for anyone that has employees. And the only thing that's shown on the Form 132 is the Social Security number, the name, hours worked, and the wages paid for the quarter. So there, it isn't like there's a large amount of proprietary information on the Form 132. It's a pretty simple form. I mean,
that's true, Mr. Chair, but I believe by adding this provision, it would give employers the time to, you know, get comfortable with the system and adapt to it.
Further discussion on the amendment? The motion to adopt amendment. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Snow?
No.
Representative Lundquist?
No.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
No.
Chair Byer?
No. Having not received the required number of votes, the amendment is not adopted. We now have an unamended bill in front of us, an A and gross version.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Knoten moves Senate Bill 1086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. 1086A. We do have the fiscal on the bill says indeterminate under the effect of the expenditures. As I'm reading the verbiage, it's down there in Iowa. Oregon could be anticipated to have up as much as $76,000, actually $86,000 for the next biennium. I don't know. Indeterminate apparently means we can send it to the floor because it doesn't say that there is a fiscal. So just thought I'd throw that in for the record. I don't want to have it come up on the floor that we sent down a bill that needs to go to Ways and Means. So.
Seems to be pretty customary.
Well, there was one last night.
Not from this committee, it has like that. So, anyway, with that, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Knope?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Have received the required number of votes. Senate Bill 1086 moves forward with a due pass recommendation. You want to volunteer to carry this? Actually, there's another one today. There's somebody else. Representative Knope wants it. He's got his hand out. Close the work session. We have two more committee meetings. But to the best of my knowledge, we will be done with our work on Wednesday of next week. We are adjourned.